solve large, intractable problems.
It's a new venture altogether.
Your brain is a wild horse there.
Because remember, writing is not a team sport.
You are not selling horse carriages when there are cars.
I want to be known only as a trusted advisor.
More like a tourist.
Play to Potential Podcast.
Well, you imagine that you are the owner of an office building and that the tenants in the building, they are complaining about the speed of the elevator. It's too slow. What many people do there is to take the problem for granted. Okay, the elevator is slow. And then they swing into solution mode and say, how do we make it faster? Do we put in a better motor, or, you know, do we have to go out and buy a new elevator for that matter? What a clever landlord might suggest is instead that you put up a mirror next to the elevator. Because, of course, what happens is when people see a mirror, they look at themselves and they fall in love and they forget time. And the underlying idea there is, what problem are you solving? That a mirror is not necessarily a solution to a slow elevator. A mirror is a solution to the problem that people think it's annoying to wait. Mm. So that's that. It's a simple example, and it really encapsulates that difference between jumping into solution mode, going in and trying to analyze the problem, which is asking, why is the elevator slow? And then the crucial difference between analyzing it and framing it right, which is the question, wait, is this really about the speed of the elevator? Or is there something else going on? Is there perhaps a better problem to solve?
Welcome to the 92nd Conversation at the Play to Potential podcast. A series of reflective conversations from leading people from various domains on three broad themes: leadership, transitions, and careers. Just like businesses think about where to play and how to win in the context of their strategy, we all need to think about the two questions, where to go and how to grow, at various points in our lives. These questions become that much harder in a world of abundance, multiplicity of options, and limited feedback as you grow through the ranks. Through this podcast, I hope to share some insights that might help you navigate these questions in a more thoughtful and a deliberate way. While podcasting accounts for 10 to 20% of my time and effort, my primary vocation is that of an executive coach and a sounding board with CEOs and entrepreneurs. I engage with leaders and organizations with a growth mindset and help them play to their unique potential. You can learn more about the podcast and my work at www.playtopotential.com. That's playtopotential.com. My guest this time is Thomas Weddell Weddelsberg. Thomas is the author of the recently published book, What's Your Problem? A book on how to solve the right problems. I believe while in the early years we are taught to solve problems well, leadership at senior levels is often about picking the right problems to solve and framing them well. You often have teams to take care of the problem solving. Your distinctive value add in these situations is your ability to frame the problems well. I hope you will find this conversation as informative as I did. Thomas holds an MA in Media Science from the University of Copenhagen and an MBA from ESA Business School in Spain. Prior to his business career, Thomas served for 4 years as an officer with the Danish Royal Guards. Without further ado, let's dive into the conversation with Thomas. Thomas, really excited to have you at the Play to Potential podcast. Thank you so much for making the time.
A pleasure, Deepak.
And I know we went back and forth, so thanks for being patient with the scheduling process in this one. Would love to dive into your recently published book, Thomas, What's Your Problem? But before that, I find it helpful to understand how people got here. So can you talk a little bit about the arc of curiosity that led you to writing this book?
It was really anchored in my work with companies around innovation. So I live in the space between academia and practice. And in 2013, I had published a book with Harvard Business Press called Innovation as Usual. And that led me to be involved in a lot of companies coming in and doing training or keynote speaking or similar things with them. And more, I just noticed something curious about problem solving. And that this kind of the book, as the title indicates, is really about the need to solve the right problems, what I call framing. And it just struck me very clearly that I was working with very talented people. They were in Fortune 500 companies. They were senior leaders, many of them. And yet, at the same time, many of them weren't very good at this this skill called problem framing. And that really stood out to me. I think most clearly I did a thing on the West Coast in San Francisco for a client with a Fortune 500 company in the tech space. And they had gathered like their top 2% performers across different seniority groups. We had a week-long program with them. And there are some really interesting people there too. I did a session on this skill of problem framing. And that ended up being the highest rated session after the entire week. Now, that was nice from my perspective, of course. Hey, I did a good session. But at the same time, it really just brought home, or it worried me, because if we have these really talented senior people in a top company that aren't good at this crucial skill, like, how come this is not something we already know? How come it's not something that, you know, somebody should write a book about that? And then, you know, and then my publisher Harvard, they agreed with that. And that's really what led to it. So I think in a nutshell, it was the interaction with practitioners and seeing what type of mistakes they made, even the smart people.
And very, very early in the book, you had my attention with your usage of the elevator problem, and you know how that's a great example of how sometimes reframing can lead us to a much better answer. So can you talk a little bit about just that problem and how that's a good case study for us to understand, you know, the impact of reframing?
Yeah. Well, you imagine that you are the owner of an office building, and that the tenants in the building, they are complaining about the speed of the elevator. It's too slow. What many people do there is to take the problem for granted. Okay, the elevator is slow. And then they swing into solution mode and say, how do we make it faster? Do we put in a better motor? Or, you know, do we have to go out and buy a new elevator for that matter? What a clever landlord might suggest is instead that you put up a mirror next to the elevator. Because, of course, what happens is when people see a mirror, they look at themselves and they fall in love and they forget time. And the underlying idea there is, what problem are you solving? That's a mirror is not necessarily a solution to a slow elevator. A mirror is a solution to the problem that people think it's annoying to wait. So that's it's a simple example. And it really encapsulates that difference between jumping into solution mode, going in and trying to analyze the problem, which is asking, why is the elevator slow? And then the crucial difference between analyzing it and framing it right, which is the question, wait, is this really about the speed of the elevator? Or is there something else going on? Is there perhaps a better problem to solve?
And you go on to say in the book, Thomas, that as such, solving tough problems is not always about the details or about being particularly a systematic thinker. It can be equally about interpretation and sense-making, about seeing what's already there, but really rethinking what it means. Can you say more about the statement? It sort of suggests a certain level of perception, a certain level of listening and awareness to what's going on around you.
I
would love for you to expand.
I really, in some ways, link this to the difference between the humanities and the natural sciences, where I noticed many people who are good at numbers, good at analysis, well, they will tend to jump in there. Talking about the elevator problem, they might say, well, exactly how fast is the elevator? Like, how many people are using it? And they're very skilled at that. And they immediately start quantifying the problem and dissecting it. And that's all great. But the other perspective I'm talking about is really holding back from doing that. Like, don't necessarily jump straight into that, because then you become trapped in the first framing of the problem. What this skill set is about is almost taking a step back and noticing, hey, what's going on here? We have a client who's complaining about something, but is that really the issue that we are necessarily dealing with? So there's this strange, I almost like the physical metaphor of thinking, do you delve straight into the problem? Or do you actually first take a step back and try to see a broader context, try to reinterpret what you're being presented with, so to speak?
Mm-hmm. And I love the way you connect it to our wiring and our training. I'm an engineer by training. And you're right. I think there's a temptation to, if you have a hammer, there's a temptation to see the world full of nails and sort of look for nails to hit, but maybe there's something else to be solved. And really resisting the default wiring, which gets you to see the world in a certain way and look at what else is out there. So I love the way you link it to the way we might be wired because of our training.
Very true. And you're exactly right with the hammer. I think is it Abraham Kaplan or Abraham Maslow who first says it, like, yeah, if you give a kid a hammer, they see everything as nails. It really captures that idea, I think.
And you also talk about the myth of the false binary, right? Sometimes, you know, as leaders, people are presented options as A or B, but maybe there is a C out there, or D or E or F. So can you talk a little bit about how we ensure we don't get trapped in sort of a false binary kind of a context?
The first step is really to recognize it. And so this part of this work is built on another reframing thinker, Roger Martin, who's written extensively about this. I really like the historical anecdote of Henry Kissinger, the U.S. statesman, who's joking and he's saying, well, how do you handle a president and kind of, you know, how do you work as a civil servant with them? And he says, well, if you want a president to continue working with your current policy, then you say, Mr. President, we have three options: surrender, the current policy, or nuclear war. Like, you know, it really beautifully encapsulates how the person defining the options, they have a lot of power that they may use for good or not for good necessarily. So I think it is really about recognizing whenever you're faced with, hey, here are your two options, your immediate question should be, well, is there maybe a third option? Or maybe even the option of not choosing anything right now, but delaying the decision for that matter. Like, we know from a lot of studies of decision making that the second you go in and create more options for yourself, your tendency to make a good choice, it improves dramatically. So be wary of those kind of, here's A or B options that life sometimes presents us with.
There's a funny anecdote here. As a parent, I have a 12-year-old and an 8-year-old. With the younger one, we actually tried this, right? In the spirit of getting him to eat healthy stuff, we'd present two healthy options as a choice. You know, do you want carrots or broccoli? And he sort of fell for it a couple of times. The third time he said, I think there's chocolates in the fridge.
That's on you. That's on you for having smart kids. It's a lot easier if the kids are stupid.
It's a double-edged sword, but you're right. Yeah. I think much to be grateful for. I think maybe a more real-life situation. Actually, this happened to me when I went for a coffee shop. Let's say this is a Starbucks equivalent, an Indian equivalent of Starbucks. I remember walking up to the counter looking to order a coffee, and the guy said, what do you want, medium or large? And I sort of paused there and said, do you have a small? He said, yes, we do. And then he sort of gave me a small. But sometimes people, especially in retail, present options and they know that you're rushed and they want you to pick quickly. And they give you a sort of an adverse selection of the menu. So
totally. And a beautiful example, even like you can do this with very small things as well. I wouldn't be surprised if that wasn't accidental. From that coffee chain, they probably at some point discovered, hey, this actually increases our sales if we ask. And you know, it's benign. Clients or customers still have the option of choosing the small one if they want. We're just nudging them.
Nudging, exactly. Yeah, I think I was reading the book Nudge by Richard Thaler, and he talks about the way you present options and how, you know, that leads to how people pick, whether it's pensions or whether it's Netflix subscription. So
exactly. It's a very good point, I think. I would add to that, you can even sometimes do this with choices that seem binary. Like an example is, let's say you don't have kids and you are trying to decide, should I have kids or not? That is pretty binary by nature. But even then, you can go in and change the question to say, under what conditions would I want to have kids? Then you start to think differently about it versus as a kind of a yes or no choice, if you will.
It's a great point. And maybe just moving into this realm of, you know, external versus internal inquiry, right? One is about, you know, solving elevators and solving, you know, coffee chain problems. But the other is sort of reflecting on our journeys, our lives, our choices, and understanding ourselves, where clearly, you know, we have eyes to see the world, but sometimes the eyes that see ourselves are quite heavily tinted, as you would appreciate. So one of the questions that come to mind is, given that there are multiple biases that come into play when we sort of go on the internal inquiry, a couple of questions. One is, how do we try and stay objective in that pursuit? Second is, what is the plane at which we conduct the inquiry, right? As a coach, sometimes people come and ask me, you know, how do I play to my potential? Sometimes they say, I've made all the money. What do I do with my time? Sometimes they say, how do I choose A career versus B career or C career? Or sometimes they say, how do I make the biggest impact? And, you know, it's, you can keep it tactical, you can keep it philosophical, and you can sort of go as deep or as broad. So how do you think about getting the plane right to solve some of these lines of inquiry?
I almost want to break that up into two things. Like there's the external, internal thing, which you highlighted.
Yes.
Asking about how do we remain objective despite all these biases. My answer to that is, in brief, I don't think we can. Like being aware of your biases is not the same as being capable of superseding them. So there is a shortcut to that, which is to involve other people in your considerations. That's why I think coaching can be so powerful, or even just having good friends whom you can draw on. There is something, you can't get objectivity, but you can get, if you like, intersubjectivity, meaning you pull different people in with different biases, and somewhere between that, between them or among them, you start to get a more neutral perspective, and maybe a slightly more distanced perspective on the problems that you are struggling with. So that's one of the reasons I think we've always had coaches, because we instinctively understand the power of having somebody else involved in discussing an internal problem you're facing. I almost want to hear if you had what your experience has been on that front as well. I mean, you have worked with us too. Do you have other pieces of advice?
Very true. I think that's a great point. I think one of the pieces of insight I got was from a lady called Tasha Urich, who's written a book called Insight, which is about how do you deepen your self-awareness. And one of the things she says, which has stayed with me, is she said internal self-awareness and external self-awareness, which is when you involve others, are often orthogonal. You know, you would think that they are highly correlated, but her insight was that people can sometimes tell you things that are completely in your blind spot, and that can be really powerful. You know, a related point came up in my another conversation with a gentleman called Dan Cable. He's a professor at London Business School. And he says that when you're trying to, you know, reinvent your career or, you know, take stock and move forward, get others to contribute to your highlights reel. He sort of uses the metaphor of sports. And he says, just like you might have a highlights reel of a baseball game or a basketball game, what would your highlights reel look like in the last 40 years, 50 years, whatever? And you might be a poor judge of the difference you've made to others. So get others to contribute. And that might tell you something about yourself that you yourself might not be aware of. So I guess all of these point to the roughly similar point, right? Involve others in what shape or form. Yeah. I guess it's a choice.
I agree. And I think both Dan Cable and Tasha Urich's perspective are kind of hitting that same point. I especially love whenever I think of Tasha Urich's insights, I'm kind of like thinking about that person who goes to a two-week retreat in the mountains and thinks deep thoughts about themselves and really connects to what they're thinking while still being utterly clueless that, you know, most of their team thinks they're arrogant because you're not going to learn that on the mountaintop. You are going to have to talk to people in your life. And here, I love Dan's approach because it's positive. It asks, hey, when did I show up as the best version of myself? When did I make a positive difference for you? That's just a great way to kind of both get an outside perspective and also kind of listen into, you know, give other people in your life a chance to kind of guide you a little bit in your path.
True. And lean into what makes you distinctive, right? Rather than trying to fix issues, I guess it's about us discovering what makes us distinctive and playing the game that lends itself to that distinctiveness. I think a more personal anecdote is when I was at the cusp of transition between McKinsey and Egon Zehnder about 13, 14 years back. I remember a senior director, at that time I was evaluating options like VC, PE, strategic planning roles, operating roles, etc. And one of the senior partners, a gentleman called Ramesh Mangaleshwaran, looked at me and said, I have a sense that you have an aptitude for executive search. Have you thought about it? And at that time, I didn't even know what executive search was as a profession. The fact that this could be a profession and the fact that I could be a fit. And then he said, I'll introduce you to this guy at Egon Zehnder. And that led to a chain of events, which eventually led me to joining Egon Zehnder. But the point is, if I really trace back to the genesis of that pathway, it was that outside an input that I could have never discovered in a mountaintop, you know, to your point.
Yeah. There is something paradoxical about that, right? Because I think of it both as with identity, who we are, what we're good at, and with the specific problem you're trying to solve. In both cases, we can be too close to see things clearly. Like, you can have a problem that you have struggled with for, you know, like in career or work or personal life or whatever. You've struggled with it for 5 years. You really know the problem in some sense. And yet, what I found consistently, hearing somebody else's perspective, somebody who's further away from it than you are, can really be a game changer. It can give you exactly as it happened to you, it sounds like, suddenly a new thought where you're just like, oh, I hadn't thought about that before, despite having, you know, been you your entire life. We still need that outside perspective.
This is your host, Deepak Jayaraman here. When I work with leaders in the context of helping them play to their unique potential, I find it helpful to spend the first 3-4 months really getting to the bottom of questions like, when do you come alive? What makes you distinctive? When do you experience highs and lows? What matters to you? And so on. I do that by indulging the leader in a series of journaling questions and by speaking to about 20-30 people around the leader at work and on the personal front, whether it's close friends or relatives. When I play that back to the leader, that often widens the self-awareness and also gives a leader a certain set of criteria by which they can evaluate solution sets as they appear. I still don't have a clean answer on what is the right way to frame the question as we go through life. The working version I have is, am I playing to my full potential in all aspects of my life, given my current context and given what I care about? Needless to say, this is a work in progress and I'm sure this will evolve as I move through life. If this particular question intrigues you, you might like my recent conversation with Ravi Venkatesan, who's authored the book, What the Heck Do I Do With My Life? We cover some of the ground in the context of this question. If you're deriving value from the podcast, do take a moment and leave a review at Apple, Spotify, or wherever you end up consuming the content. Now, let's get back to the conversation with Thomas. Moving forward, Thomas, you know, one of the things you talk about is, you know, presented problems versus open-ended problems. And you go on to say, you know, there are three types of open-ended problems: something around a pain point, something around a nebulous goal, or a solution someone fell in love with. You know, that's like a solution in search of a problem. So can you talk a little bit about some of these archetypes of open-ended problems and what that means for us in terms of how we frame the right problem?
So one of the early thinkers of around problem solving, a man called Jacob Getzels, he started really to notice that the types of problems we teach children in schools to solve, they're quite different from our real-life problems in the sense that a problem you get in school, it is presented. It is like, here's a triangle, here are the sides, this angle, you know, what is this, like the third angle or the third length of the third side or whatever. So somebody has already very clearly defined the problem, and what we need to do is to solve it. In real life, of course, that's not the case most of the time. Like the vast majority of the problems we are faced with, they don't come across, we don't come across them as neatly packaged, clearly defined problems. We come across them as some sort of mess. And what I highlight in the book is really that there are three typical versions of that. There is the undefined pain point, which is just like, hey, I'm in a bad mood and I don't know why. Or, hey, I feel my career isn't going in the right direction, but I actually am not sure what the problem is. So that's kind of a classical, almost a proto-problem.
Mm-hmm.
You then have people come in sometimes with a goal that they're talking about. And this could be like, hey, I really want to be more successful. Or I want to be more impactful or whatever. But it's kind of fuzzy. Like, okay, what does that mean? And I think this loops back to the other question you raised before, namely, how do you take something more nebulous or like large kind of and drill that down to a tangible problem you can work on?
Hmm.
The third, before we maybe delve deeper into that one, the third version, and that's the one I always enjoy the most, is when people have fallen in love with a solution. Like, so they literally have kind of, yeah, I want to do this, or I want to build this thing, or whatever. And when you ask them, wait, what problem is that solution going to solve for you? They are not necessarily clear on it. They have just fallen in love with the idea of, I don't know, maybe doing getting a degree in something, or maybe some other thing they just are really excited about. And you of course see this in new product development too, where somebody has come up with a very exciting product that they really want to build, and nobody knows what problem it solves for customers, including the customers. Which is not typically a good starting point.
If I may relate a personal anecdote on the third one, you know, at some stage I was into, you know, running half marathons, and the first level goal was to run it under 2 hours. I did it. And then I said, I want to run it under 145. And I started training for it. And at some stage, my wife asked me, you know, why exactly are you doing it? And I said, okay, you're not going to be, you know, an elite runner by any stretch of imagination. So treat it like a hobby and take a chill pill in life, right? And I think it was a good wake-up call. Sometimes that was a case of me falling in love with something without really questioning the need for it.
Yeah, and I imagine like you being I think you are a high performer. Of course, when you get into something, you're like, no, I want to do even better.
Yes, yes.
And is that I think it's such a powerful question to say, wait, is the purpose of what I'm doing? You know, it's like going on a vacation and trying to speed read the book you brought. Kind of like, no, that's not the point. The point is to lie on the beach and slow read it. It's kind of
another guest on the podcast was a gentleman called Tom Vanderbilt. He's written a book called Beginners and How You Can Pick Up Something New. And he uses this term about how cyclists in New York City sometimes get obsessive about some of these milestones. And he has a term. He says there's a term for it, MAMIL, M-A-M-I-L, which is middle-aged men in Lycra shorts. who get obsessive about some of these goals but miss the bigger picture. Yeah. But anyway, back to you were talking about the three.
I just love, we shouldn't stereotype, but that stereotype is exactly correct. It's kind of, I think that, well, you asked a little earlier, how do you work with somebody's problem when it is that vague and abstract? And I think it is really helpful to try to make it even extremely tangible. So this is not my research, but that question called the miracle question, which is, imagine that you achieved what you wanted, your problem got solved, and overnight, magically, and you wake up tomorrow morning, what is the first thing you notice that's different? So you start to understand, perhaps, what success looks like. Like, well, I jump out of the bed. Versus just lying there for half an hour and checking the news. Why do you jump out of bed? Well, because I'm really excited about what I'm going to do. Okay, so then you start to gradually unpack whatever it is into almost specific either decision points or even using the highlights exercise, or like the, I call them bright spots, going in and figuring out what has worked for me in the past, what got you to jump out of bed in the morning in the past, and is there something there we can use to get closer to your challenge? Now, you work with people here. What other approaches do you use yourself when somebody comes in with a nebulous or unclear goal?
True. Sometimes I find the sequence of whys helpful, you know. Whys is important. One of the exercises I try and get the people I work with do is to talk about their life, think about their life 5 years out, 10 years out. What are the different, just do the simple exercise where you pick an identity, you know, as a father, as a mother, as a sibling, as a CEO, as an entrepreneur, and pick one adjective. I want to be an affectionate father, be a responsible entrepreneur, or be an ambitious entrepreneur. You get the idea. Pick an adjective and an identity. Just write that out. Then take another page and just put those two words at the top. I want to be an ambitious entrepreneur. Why is that important to you? Just list that down.
Yeah.
And then take each of these and say, why is that important to you? Basically, what you're doing is you're taking if you imagine the human being as an iceberg, you're sort of going deeper and deeper down the iceberg. And of course, it's not a finite pursuit. But I think the closer we get to what our needs are, what do we really care about? You know, what do we value and what do we fear? The chances are we'll end up solving problems which are relevant and more meaningful. And as you rightly say, in coaching, one of the things we say is, you know, are we solving a problem which, if solved, will have a disproportionate impact, right? When you come to a development area, when you look at the feedback for a leader, there are 20 things, right? You could be better at this, you could be better at that. But finally, you want to pick two things or three things which, if solved, has a disproportionate impact. So to your question, I think this sort of the why exercise I find helpful, both in terms of clarifying for myself every now and then, but also clarifying for the leaders I work with so that we know where it comes from.
I think that's really helpful, because one thing I've noticed when talking to people about problems is everybody can very quickly generate a list of 20 problems they're facing. And it might actually be the case that none of those 20 really are the important problems to solve. So I love the focus of kind of saying not just, hey, what's the problem you're dealing with, but kind of what problem, if solved, would really be a game changer for you. Let's talk about that problem. And that I think it also requires some degree of vulnerability or risk taking in the person, because some, you know, we're all comfortable talking about how we get too many emails. If it comes to your person and who you are, those can be tougher problems to start to dig into, I'd say.
Very true, Thomas. Just moving forward, one of the things you say in the book, which really caught my attention, and I quote from the book, you say, designers distinguish between features and benefits. Negotiators distinguish between positions and interests. And policy wonks between outputs and outcomes. Talk to us about what's the nuance here.
To me, the insight here is that no matter what field you work with, if you look at the professionals, especially professionals who kind of solve problems for others, well, then they typically have some kind of language recognizing this. So in the policy world, you know, you go in and you say, hey, we need to build a courthouse in this region. And then everybody focuses on that because we can look at it when it's done. But what is that? That's kind of the output. What is the ultimate outcome you want? And that's probably not a courthouse. That is better justice in the region, you know, which can be a different problem to solve for compared to the simpler one of, hey, how do we build a building? So I think that's in one area. You see it almost no matter what industry you work with, you will discover that there's some recognition of the need to unpack a goal or a problem. Like, okay, you want to become an author. Why do you want to become an author? Well, there may be a component about spreading good ideas. There may be a component about wanting to get on talk shows. maybe a component about identity. I want to be somebody who is like recognized, smart, having written a book is still like the classic way of kind of signaling that and so on. So that need, and I think your why questions, that need really needs to be surfaced before you can do effective problem solving, lest you just start attacking the most immediate thing that may not actually deliver on what you truly want.
Really powerful. You know, I think this came through in one of my conversations with a gentleman called Stu Friedman from Wharton. And he talks about four domains of life, right? How do you think about yourself, which is your physical, mental health, spiritual health, how you think about your time at work, how you think about your family, and how you think about your community. And he says that you need to think about this four-piece jigsaw in a meaningful way as you go through life. But he goes on to say that it's one thing for you to figure out the jigsaw for yourself, but your family might not be aligned with where you want to go, right? And you want to sort of carry them along. And he says, how do you do that? There he says, you don't talk about positions. You talk about interests. You know, you don't say, I'll spend an hour with the kids. No, you really say, if I have to be an affectionate father, what are the different mechanisms? And really solve for the primary need and not for the surface commitment, which is, you know, maybe, you know, you might have a ritual saying, you know, I'll have maybe one meal with the family in a restaurant every week. But you don't want to take it literally. You want to sort of distill it to what exactly is the need we are solving. And maybe have a conversation with your spouse and with the other people around you to sort of get into an equilibrium. So it came up in that context.
I'll share an example from my own life, which is I don't have children yet. I do have nieces and nephews, and they live in a different country. They live in Denmark, where I'm originally from, and I'm based in the US. And so it's difficult to stay connected to them. And one thing I was tempted to do is kind of go, well, I should, whenever they have a birthday or Christmas, I'll just give them a really nice present. But then I realized that that's a nice symbol. But really what I wanted to do was actually to connect with them. And so I started thinking of gifts that I could give them while we were together. So, you know, basic stuff, but like taking them out shopping. Go out and spend a couple of hours shopping with your niece, and kind of that was a gift to her and it was a gift to me, and kind of is something we start suddenly trying, like building a little bit of connection, even though that I'm away out most of the time. And that problem and a lovely present wrapped in the nice paper or whatever would not solve. So a simple example of kind of thinking about the outcomes, your interests, if you will, versus what you said, the position or the needed kind of stated thing we're looking at.
Yeah, very true, Thomas. If I may share, that triggers another anecdote, right? I think I'm a part of a WhatsApp group, multiple WhatsApp groups, but a couple of them are my batchmates from my high school, batchmates from my engineering college and so on. And typically we'd observe that people are wishing happy birthday, happy birthday, happy birthday on the day of somebody's birthday. Then one of them turned around and said, why don't we ask the birthday boy or girl to just write an update on their life once a year? You just write an update. The idea is for us to stay connected to each other's lives and understand what's going on.
Yeah.
So why don't we just turn this sort of bland, meaningless ritual into something a little more purposeful? And then we started see people saying, you know, we sing, or we like cooking, or we like sailing, or we like hiking. And then that triggers a chain of real conversations around interests, around passions, around, you know, pain points in some cases. So you're right. I think there's an opportunity for us to question the rituals and really, really ask what are we solving for in that mode of interaction.
I love that example. That is such a good example of a super simple habit that has specific triggers. Namely, when it is my birthday, I write a short update on what's going on in my life. Much better than what you're suggesting there. So this makes me think of something important I realized with problem solving, that in some sense, we tend to focus on our biggest problems. Like, I have this either a strategic challenge I'm facing right now, or a very difficult key client, or maybe this career consideration I'm in the middle of. But really, problem solving is a thinking skill that if you get good at it, you can start to apply it to even very small things. And just by virtue of finding smarter solutions to small things, you start to generate a much better surplus with which to tackle some of the bigger problems as well. So to me, it's really ultimately a mindset that you go in and you relentlessly apply to anything from strategic problems to how do we stay connected with my high school batch or the university batch you're dealing with. Really, really interesting example.
Got it. Just building on this, Thomas, you've been thinking a lot about how to teach reframing. If that's a mindset, one of the questions that emerges for me is, how does one as a parent think about inculcating that with children as they grow up, right? So that it becomes a way of life, so that they sort of over time build the mindset of asking the right questions.
I've seen many approaches to this with the note that I am not a parenting expert, but I think there are parents that work deliberately with having children ask questions. So they say, not what did you learn today, but what questions did you ask today? And kind of going in and thinking in that sense, I think this is broader than just reframing. It's all around curiosity and questioning skills. Having said that, I want to share an anecdote because I teach this normally to leaders in companies, but I was invited to teach my reframing workshop to a bunch of kids age 5, 6, and 7.
Wow.
A friend of mine runs a like what's called an elementary prep school here in the US and knew of my work. So I said, come up and let's do it. And I was like, okay, we will try it, but I'm not sure how well this is going to work. To be honest, you know, I don't work with kids normally, so I didn't know their abstraction level. It was really interesting to see. So two observations there. One is that kids can actually understand this better than you think. When I taught the session later, they sent me some footage of some of the kids explaining it to their parents. Oh, here's this thing with problems, blah, blah, blah. And I was like, wait, they actually understood that. So I think first observation is you can probably start guiding them fairly early whenever they have a problem to try to understand why it is a problem. And then a second observation that struck me here. We tend to think that if you ask immediately, like, hey, what kind of problems do kids have? Most people say, well, it's about the bedtime, or it's about homework, or it's about the iPad that they can't spend enough time with, and so on. What I saw in that session was almost none of the problems that the kids chose to work on had anything to do with parents. Parents think that, oh, it's the iPad, because that's my biggest problem. But in actuality, the problems that the kids raised had to do with their friends, their brothers, and their sisters. Those were the problems that really took up their thinking time. Not that kids have basically accepted that we're evil dictators and they're okay with it. So that's great news. Fundamentally, it struck me because we tend to think, even with people we live with, we tend to think too quickly that we understand what their biggest problems are. And in fact, you have to ask. You can't just assume you know what somebody's problem is, even if you have known them literally their entire lives.
It's a great insight. It's about really putting yourself in their shoes and understanding the world from their perspective and not from your perspective, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. And moving forward, Thomas, you talk about, you ask us to look at our contribution to the problem while framing a problem. Can you talk a little bit about this notion of contributing to the problem and how that distorts the framing?
It's a term that I have from Doug Stone, Sheila Heen, and Bruce Patton, who wrote the book Difficult Conversations. And what they point out is really when something goes wrong or when there's a problem, we tend to talk about blame, like who's to blame for this, meaning who should be punished. And what they point out with this concept of contribution is, well, you can see this problem as having arisen because multiple people did or didn't do something that helped it happen. So the real question is here, not who's to blame, which is like finding one person you can point at, but saying, looking at us as almost a system, how did each of us contribute to this problem happening? And it can really be powerful because it both opens up a mentality where you're more collaborative around fixing it, and it can recognize that even if it was, in fact, mostly your colleague over here who created the problem, there's also something you can do to prevent it from happening again. So it takes a more nuanced view on why problems happen compared to this, like, oh, it's just because this person was an idiot.
Hmm.
That's contribution.
Got it. And that's a great insight. I guess what you're saying is it's not so much about external attribution is easy to say, you know, I'm okay, you're not okay. That's the easy part. But really to take ownership and to have agency and to sort of focus on your end of the bargain as well as you're part of the system. So it's a little more of, I guess, a system thinking kind of a thing, saying, you know, you have a role to play as well.
The example that I talk about in the book is a leader I met whom he worked in a factory, and it was his job, whenever there's like something going wrong on the manufacturing floor, it was his job to have a conversation with the people who were involved and fix the problem so it didn't happen again. And of course, as you can imagine, when you're called into your boss's office and something bad happened, you are kind of worried, you're defensive, and so on. And so he had this very powerful technique of starting the conversation without saying, well, we've had this issue. Tell me how the company failed you. Like putting out there very clearly, we know kind of you probably did some things that we need to think about, but we also did something since this could happen. So it was a way to kind of open the conversation in a way that both took in contribution and that notion, but also signaled, hey, we're not looking to pin this on just one person and saying you're bad. We're actually trying to think together as a team about how to prevent this, and we recognize that we have played a part in that too.
And in the book, in a different section, Thomas, you talk about the difference between empathy and perspective taking. You know, sometimes I notice that I sort of use them interchangeably. So can you bring about the distinction between the two and how it sort of links to this problem solving?
The common way of thinking about empathy is people just like, well, understand how they feel. So if you're in a conflict with a family member or a colleague, how do they feel about this? That, though, we know from the research is only one part of the picture, and it's not always the most helpful one to zoom in on. Cognitive empathy, if you will, or perspective taking, is really about understanding not just what they feel, but also more external things like, what do they know? Like, do they have the same information about this that I do in my head? Or are there things they're not aware of? What was their situation when this happened? So almost taking an external perspective instead of trying to focus only on what's happening, you know, with their emotions at the moment. I like this simple way of explaining it, which is to say, imagine that you your neighbor is building a fence and they hit their, we spoke about hammers before, they hit their thumb with a hammer.
Mm-hmm.
Empathy is to feel their pain. Perspective taking is to understand why they're building the fence. It is a broader perspective, a broader way than just getting anchored or caught up only in the emotional part of things.
Got it. And another point you make at a different point in the book is about, you know, how we frame questions so that we elicit authentic responses. I think you talk about this in the context of having exit interviews with people who leave a company. And very often these end up being very bland conversations. And you actually mentioned that sometimes the real, the juice can come out when you ask a contract question, which is, tell me how the company failed you, you know, rather than the other way around. So can you talk a little bit about eliciting the next level of insight and the wisdom of framing the right questions?
So exit interviews is such a good example of that, because when you ask people, so you decided to leave our company, why do you do it? People tend to say, well, I got a better offer. Why do they say that? Well, A, it's maybe true. But also they highlight that because it is a non-contentious reason for leaving. If you just say, well, I got a better offer, I understand that. You're not burning any bridges. The reality might be that they left it, you know, their offer was only a little bit better, but what really mattered to them was to get away from a specific leader that they really couldn't work very well with. And so that doesn't come up if you just accept the first answer that's put on the table. It's not that it's wrong. It may be true, but there's typically more to the story. So even just asking, oh yeah, I totally understand that. And what else would you add to that? Other factors. Like just ask more questions than necessarily accepting the surface value of the first thing that they put on the table.
That's interesting. For me, to provide a contra view, I used to be a search consultant in my previous life at Egon Zehnder. And very often, candidates would often call you, the candidates that don't make the final list, saying, do you have any feedback from me? And very often, the lazy answer or the non-committal answer would be, no, there was a better candidate, or, you know, this wasn't a good fit for you. But really, you know, even if I go back to some of my conversations, it would require courage to give that hard feedback, saying, you know, you came across as too greedy, or you came across as too operational or not strategic, or whatever the reason might be. And very often, that's often the bitter truths in the moment. But, you know, 5 years later or 10 years later, some of these people call you and say, you know, thank you for that feedback. It was valuable. Yeah. If you hadn't told me, then I wouldn't have had the opportunity to correct it. So it's quite a profound point indeed.
I have noticed in my own life that I have sometimes been held back from sharing honest feedback because of the fear of the reaction. And whenever I really think about it, when I have tried giving direct feedback, it's very rare to get negative reactions. Or even if you do, I think, as you point out, they may have an initial bad reaction, and then later it kind of actually hits home for them. And it does require courage, and it does require you, it's almost an investment in them. It is a belief in them that they can become better. I'm sharing this feedback with you because I think that you, the next time we work together or you work with somebody else, I think you can actually, you know, become something more powerful. Like this almost comes to your topic of potential. I believe in what you can become.
And the reason I'm giving this feedback is because I care for you, in a sense. At some level, the very fact that I'm, you know, maybe just another anecdote on this came from the man Egon Zehnder himself. When I was leaving the firm, he used to meet all the consultants, and he was quite active in the recruitment process. So I'd met him in his office in his home office in Zurich. When I was leaving the firm, I wrote a note to him saying, you know, it's been a great journey, learned a lot. Thank you for building this firm, et cetera, et cetera. And he used a phrase which stayed with me. He said, great feedback. Thoughts in your head that you don't share are a bit like gift wrapping a present and not giving it to the person, you know? So it's almost like you're, you know, he almost framed it as an obligation that you have to the people around you to share feedback. So in a way, that sort of, that back to your point about framing, once he framed it that way, each time when I think about feedback, I think about gift wrap, a present that's lying gift wrapped, and it would be a crime not to give it to the intended recipient.
I think to me, the one thing I tend to add to that is to give the recipient permission to wait. Like, so you can say, hey, I have some feedback for you. Is this a good time to share it? Or would you rather kind of take it up at a different time?
Of course.
Because I do notice, I think, that people are more likely to act on feedback once they have kind of accepted saying, okay, now I'm ready for it. Share it.
It's a great point. It's a great point. You know, it sort of triggers another insight that came up in my conversation with a gentleman called Bruce Feiler, who's written the book Life is in the Transitions. And he says, when you go through especially life quakes, you know, disruptive events in your life, try and make sense of scars, but not the wounds. You know, he says that don't try to process these things too soon. Wait for some time to elapse. Let the wound become a scar. And then maybe you might be in a better position to make sense. So to your point, I think there's an element of timing as well. Is the person in a position to process what you want to tell him or her.
So what you're sharing there is, as far as I know, supported by some of the research into post-traumatic events. So if you've been through a very rough event of some kind, there used to be a tendency to try to debrief you as quickly as possible. Like, okay, we need to get you right away in and talk through the entire thing and so on. And it turns out that tends actually to have better results if you give it a bit of time, where you let the mind do its own kind of, as like creating the scar tissue versus delving straight in. And what if I remember this correctly, what would happen sometimes is if you debrief too early, you almost actually fixed the bad event in people's minds to a greater degree than if you had allowed them to get a little bit of a distance from it. So I think there is something very powerful about that understanding of when do we go, when is the right moment to start to go in and kind of either give feedback or process something that happened or whatnot.
Great insight. Moving forward, Thomas, you say that sometimes while handling a tricky situation like a hostage crisis, rather than asking an explicit question about what they want, we're actually better off labeling a fear, you know, saying it seems like something that they might harbor to get to a better solution. I found, again, the link between a hostage situation and framing quite interesting. So can you say more about this piece?
Yeah, this is an insight from Chris Voss, who wrote the book Never Split the Difference. It's a book about negotiation, and he is or has been a hostage negotiator for the FBI. And he talks about this method of labeling, which is the function of labeling is to put emotions into play. Like normally we're discussing something and the emotions of what's going on are unaddressed or kind of lurking in the background. What he would do, and this is a quite interesting anecdote or approach, you know, he's called in, somebody's locked themselves in an apartment with a gun and there's hostages and they don't want to go back to jail, which is what will happen if, you know, the police comes in. And he just found, instead of starting to say, hey, you need to come out, or all of the demands and all of that, you just start saying, hey, it seems like you're really worried about us coming in shooting. It seems like you're really worried about the idea of going back to jail. Like. And according to him, it does something magical in the conversation. It just allows you to put the not just the facts, but also the emotions on the table so you can start working on that too. So very simple technique here for, not for when you're in hostage negotiations, I hope, but when you're dealing with a conflict and you're perceiving something that's going on emotionally, then you might say, hey, it seems like you're a bit upset about what just happened here. And then just see how they respond. They might say no. They might say, no, you got that wrong. I'm not upset. I'm just going to, stuff's going on. But by saying that, it seems that, or it looks like, you create an opening for them to confirm or disconfirm what's going on in their heads.
It's a beautiful insight. It opens a window to a deeper and a more authentic conversation, right? In terms of what really matters to the other person, what's not being said. And sometimes, back to your earlier point about outside in, sometimes the person himself or herself may not be aware that they are coming across in a certain way, and showing the mirror sometimes can get them to, bring it to their awareness and elicit a better response or a better situation.
Yeah, I love that actually, that people to different degrees can be aware of their own reactions, right? You can suddenly notice, hey, wait, I notice I'm feeling very tense. Why is that? You know, even just self-observing, for that matter, I think can be helpful.
I have a condition called hanger, right? When I'm hungry, I get irritated and restless. And sometimes, you know... once my wife started pointing out, saying, it seems like you're hungry, then I know, okay, that's sort of setting off a chain reaction. And sometimes, you know, sort of they need to get into the autocorrect mode.
That's one of the examples I share in the book. So the book mixes business problems and personal problems, because I found that, of course, problem solving applies equally to both. And this story of my friend Tanya and her husband Brian, who used to a great marriage, they're still married, and they had a lot of fights, like fights that got worse than they needed to be over small things. And they initially started saying, well, we're from two different countries, so maybe it's a cultural thing, and or it could be a values, blah, 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 and none of that helped. Until they started just noticing from the bright spots, hey, was there ever a time when we didn't have this problem, even though it normally would have arisen? Like, what are the positive exceptions to this? And they just noticed, well, the budget is normally very sensitive to discuss. We normally fight over it. Only this day we didn't. And why? Because unusually, we didn't have the discussion in the evening. We had it in the morning. And why was that important? Well, hanger or tiredness. You know, when you are past 10 o'clock in the evening, if you're discussing something sensitive, nobody has the mental energy to take a positive approach to that. You don't want to discuss problems when you're hangry or when you are, I don't know what angry, tired abbreviation you need to invent a name for that.
Hangered, but, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Very basic idea of starting to notice these patterns and saying, oh, there's actually a smarter approach here. Instead of trying to change who we are, just change what time we discuss sensitive matters.
Very true. At a personal level, one of the guests on the podcast was Matthew Walker, who's written the book Why We Sleep. And he talks about circadian rhythms, which is sort of people's body clocks. So in my home, I've got the body clock of a morning person, and my wife has the body clock of an evening person, a late night person rather. And when we look back, some of the best conversations we've had was a period of a few months when I was in India and she was in the US.
Oh, I love that.
So I would call her in my morning, and she'd be in a really good frame. And I said, you know, this went by. And after about a few weeks, we said, this seems to be a lot more energizing than when we are in person. And then we sort of said, actually, it's possibly because our body clocks are perfectly adjusted when we are in these time zones. So it's one
I
of
love
those
that.
Things.
I mean, that solution sounds like it comes with other drawbacks, though. The long-distance relationship.
Not to indicate it's a solution, but at least once it came into our awareness, we said, let's not discuss anything of significance either first thing in the morning or last thing at night.
Yeah, I love that.
Just, anything between lunch and tea time is generally a good time.
It's sort almost of those like, you know, when you have meetings in different time zones, it's those time zone planners when you can see, oh, here we're both green and here we're like, oh no, here you're red.
Exactly.
I love that.
Exactly. In the book, you also talk about iterating across ideation and trial. You say that, you know, sometimes when we come up with new ideas and new frames, it's important for us to pause and test it out there before we move forward. So can you talk a little bit about how we get that balance right and sort of the criticality of trial in the framing process?
I think the main point I make in the book and my work around framing is that we are often too quick to jump into action. And the book is a manifesto and a how-to guide about how not to do that. But there is, it has to be said, also a pitfall on the other end of that, which is that you get trapped in analysis. This happens especially to smart people with multiple PhD degrees. You overthink stuff, and you keep just circling around in your head around this problem, and you analyze, and you want more data, and so on. The recognition here is that you need to mix those two things. So you do want the ability to take a step back, to frame the problem differently, to analyze it and so on. And you also want to step in and start using almost like lean startup methods, you know, experiment, do stuff, talk to people. Action and analysis, when you marry those two, that's when it becomes really powerful. And the insight here is you don't have to do those two things one at a time. You can start with trying to frame it and like think deeply about the problem. Then you go spend a week trying to do stuff. And then you get your team together next Monday and say, well, given what we just did, have we learned something new about the problem? Do we still understand what it is? Have we surfaced important aspects of the customer's need that we didn't realize before we actually had to address to? So really developing that back and forth skill, switching between framing, analysis, and then making sure you move forward so you don't endlessly ruminate about a problem. You tend to know what type of person you are, or what type of which of those two pitfalls your team falls into. So just making sure you get that right as well.
Got it. And as we sort of wrap up, Thomas, I spend a lot of time talking to leaders as a coach and as a sounding board. As you think about the application of your work in the realm of coaching and sort of, let's say if we frame it as broader leadership advisory, any specific themes that you that jump out at you as obvious opportunities to use this tool of reframing to get to a better place?
I think the most powerful collaboration you can have with a coach or with any other type of person who's helping you, this be consultants or even friends or whatnot, it's when you become joint explorers of a problem. So it's not that it's your job as a coach to say, no, this is your problem. It is rather that you, with your client, together go through this process of kind of asking questions about the problem and trying to see it differently, not just going into solution mode. So I think there is a magic kind of collaboration you can get to, which also very much changes the dynamic of... Now, if you go to a coach, you are expecting them to ask questions. But often, if this is in the context of, say, consulting, very often you will see a client just treat the consultant as a vendor, as saying, no, you're the person who's going to build this for us or whatever it is, versus that more collaborative approach where you together identify the nature of the problem and then, of course, help them come up with solutions. Having said that, I was very curious to hear your thoughts on that. You work with this directly. Where do you see reframing and problem framing in general fit into the coaching work?
That's a great question, Thomas. I'm not sure if I have a clean answer to it, but I think one of the applications I've empirically observed is just that people sometimes come in with a certain framing, and helping them to reevaluate that is helpful. You know, sometimes they may frame it as a career problem. Sometimes let me share a specific example. Right, I was working with a very senior investment banker from Hong Kong, and the bank had just shut shop in Asia, and he was trying to figure out what next. You know, and he framed it as, I want to work intensely for the next 5-10 hours, and then, you know, do something else in my life. And he said, okay, therefore, what are the options? What could I do? A versus B versus C. And then as we spent time, I sort of challenged the assumption, why does it have to be a sprint for the next 5 years? And then you sort of move into whatever you call it, retirement mode or chilling out mode. Why can't you pick something that you're passionate about and maybe do this for the next 30 years or 40 years? Why do we need to... And somehow that framing changed the perspective completely and said, okay, if that's the case, then maybe I should really focus on what energizes me. And therefore, what is it that I can do for the long term that I can pivot towards, which gives me meaning, which gives me fulfillment, which takes care of the commercial needs, et cetera, et cetera. So I think it's just, to your point, what I found helpful is people come in with a default question because they've framed it in their head in a certain way. But when you sort of... ask them to consider other framings, it often ends up in a much more powerful place.
Yeah, I would recommend here, if for those of your listeners who are not themselves professional coaches but want to play that role to an extent for others, I really like the work of Michael Bungay Stainer, who wrote the book The Coaching Habit. That's kind of it's a very accessible guide for people to ask a little bit better questions when they're trying to help somebody else. So there are ways you can do this. The key thing is really just to remember this core idea. You don't necessarily want to try to help people achieve what they come in with. You actually want to step back and say, wait, why is this important to you? Or exactly as you did with the example you just shared, question their assumptions about how things... What does success look like? What is a good goal? I kind of want to share an anecdote here in the same realm. And I thought of this because you have been in the executive search space. So you can afterwards tell me whether this is still accepted practice. But the story is This is from Robert Sternberg, one of the big names in creativity research. There is this leader who is in an industry he loves, in a firm he loves, and he has a boss that he really cannot work with. It's like, oh my God, this, like, I hate my boss. It's horrible. And so he goes to a search firm and says, can you find a new position for me? As similar as possible to my old job. And the executive search person says, yeah, there's a lot of demand at the moment for senior executives like such as yourselves. This shouldn't be hard. We can easily find you something. That same night, though, he goes back and he talks to his wife. And she's good at reframing, and they have a good relationship where they can help each other with problems. And together they find a different approach, which is the next morning the leader goes back to the executive search person and says, here is the CV of my boss. Can you find a new job for him? And apparently the story goes that that's what ended up happening. Like they actually managed to find a position for the boss that the boss happily accepted without really knowing what was going on and that leader got promoted into his job. Now, it's a beautiful story. I suspect that the ethics around search may have changed a little bit and you couldn't do that today, is that a realistic story?
My first response, if I wear a search consultant's hat with a commercial objective, is that the boss is possibly paid higher than the guy, and therefore the boss's position is probably more lucrative for me.
Exactly.
So I would grab it if somebody offered that, saying, you know, take this search and this is the fee, and take the junior search and that fee.
Yeah.
My commercial hat tells me, you know, that's not a bad trade-off. But back to the point around ethics. See, the point is it's a free world, right? Unless he's sharing confidential information. Yeah. At the end of the day, it's free market. It's free markets at play. So
yeah. I mean, all he did really was to point turn position, your attention towards somebody who's like, exactly.
He sold his boss as a candidate, which is often value. As long as he didn't mislead the search consultant, I don't see any ethical issues here.
I'm glad to hear that. Then I will continue to use the story.
Absolutely. Even if he's got an idea about two levels higher, then even better for the search firm, right? So. As we wrap up, Thomas, this podcast, as you know, is titled Play to Potential. What does that term mean to you?
Potential resonates with me a lot, and I use it a lot. Like, so I don't tend to look back a lot at my career and say, hey, I've achieved these things. I published books with Harvard, blah, blah, blah. I'm very forward-focused, and I'm very focused on what I can potentially become. And I think it is, so a friend of mine who we act as each other's coaches, we tend to have discussions around, and this sounds maybe a little ambitious, but kind of what could you do where you would end up in a history book? And I mean something good, to be clear. There are bad ways of ending up in history books. But like, what is a story of your life and your future where you ultimately become somebody that are written history books about, or you're featured in some of them? I like that perspective because it lifts me up from kind of the day-to-day grumbling about, you know, here's a difficult client or whatnot. It helps me see, like, seeing the potential gives you some sort of energy. And my way of doing it is often to read biographies. And when I read a biography of interesting people, it reminds me that we can lead interesting lives. I think I can quote this from my head. We'll try. This is a famous poem from, I think it is Longfellow or Wordsworth. And it's a segment of a poem. Let me see if I can get it right here. If not, I should say this is slightly a gendered thing. He wrote it at a time where it wasn't so much men and women that were both quoted in poetry. So, take note of that. But here's the lines. Lives of great men all reminds us we can make our lives sublime, and departing leave behind us footprints on the sands of time. Whenever I hear that, I just get that does something for me. The idea of like footprints on the sands of time. What what could a life look like if you were to do that?
Wow. Really powerful, Thomas. You know, in the spirit of sharing, I was talking to a lady called Jennifer Gavi Berger on this podcast. She's based in the UK and she's a coach, and she's written a book about, you know, leadership in a world of complexity. And one of the things she says is the human mind is wired in a certain way that it overestimates the journey we've had so far and who we have become, but significantly underestimates what we could become in the future. You know, it's just a wiring. So to your point, sometimes we need to get out of a comfort zone and really think deliberately about what we could become. Otherwise, you know, our minds by themselves are probably not a good judge or a good indicator of what we could become. So really inspiring. On that note, Thomas, really, really enjoyed this conversation. Thank you for bringing spontaneity, for sort of keeping it conversational, and for all your insights.
Thanks so much for inviting me. This was a really, really rich conversation, I feel.
Lovely. Thank you. I hope you found the conversation purposeful. If you want to listen more on the topic, you might like a couple of conversations at the podcast. One is with Ravi Venkatesan, who's recently written the book, What the Heck Do I Do with My Life? A lot of what we discuss there might be relevant in the context of this conversation. Second, you might also like my conversation with Sir Andrew Lickyaman of London Business School, who studied judgment for several years. Thank you for your time and attention, and look forward to having you at a subsequent conversation at the Play to Potential podcast. To know more about the advisory work I do, you can just visit playtopotential.com and look at the section about Deepak. Bye now.